Gretchen Neils and Ed talk about the new civility movement in the legal profession and how the three, sometimes four, generations of lawyers in the same workplace need to become more aware of their differences in order to remain profitable and provide expected client services. Gretchen is founder of Neils & Company, strategic business communication based in Boston. In addition to providing consulting and training in the areas of recruiting and retention, networking, and business etiquette to professional service firms, Gretchen lends substantial expertise in the area of generational harmony. She is the author of Business Etiquette 101, 30 Absolutely Never Evers for Business, Dining and First Impressions, Business Etiquette 102, 30 Certainly, Always Guides for Interviewing, Networking in Meetings, and Cultural Detective, General Harmony. And now on to the interview.
Gretchen, for the first time in our memory, we have more than one generation in the workplace. I'm sure that places great strains on the intergenerational relationships one to the other. One of the areas of difficulty seems to be etiquette. And I guess you've become known as the etiquette guru. Even the Wall Street Journal recently quoted you on the subject. So let me ask you, why is this issue so important to today's lawyers?
That's such a great question, Ed. You know, new professionals or millennials are those folks that are born between 1980 and 2000. And so they've just started to infiltrate professional services organizations, say, in the last 5 years or so. And they bring with them very limited core skills. And core skills or soft skills include verbal and nonverbal communication, emotional intelligence, and empathy. They are the cluster of personality traits, if you will, social graces, the facility with language, personal habits, friendliness, and optimism as well that mark people to varying degrees. So the first job of an attorney is to be perceived as trustworthy and competent. I think you'd agree with that. But in order to do that, he or she must first look the part and then second act the part. Third, they want to be able to establish and nurture relationships, of course, with their clients. And people typically want to do that with people who look like them and act like them.
Well, now you're coming into a whole different area. If you're talking about working with people who look like you and perhaps think like you, act like you, I mean, isn't this sort of like the racism that we've experienced before? You know, I mean, how is it that, ageism is another phrase for that. I mean, all the isms that we know about and that we've tried to eliminate to be politically correct, isn't that, you know, part of what you're talking about?
You know, I can understand how you might go in that direction, Ed, but not at all. When you talk about diversity, diversity is a beautiful thing, especially when it comes to culture, language, ways of thinking. You know, it makes the workplace so much more interesting and vibrant. However, chaos can ensue when you've got people playing by different sets of rules, one group playing by rules and another group ignoring rules. So when I say people want to do business with folks who look and act like them, I don't mean necessarily in the sense of being a certain skin color or being from a certain country. What I'm saying is, on the surface, that they look alike in terms of their dress, their comportment. They're following the rules that have been laid down over the last maybe 75 years, people doing business. That's really what I mean. The other piece, which is very interesting, you know, the diversity, that's quite another thing. And I think that as we move on in our culture, we're getting away from that we are embracing diversity. I think our election is showing that right now, that there's tremendous opportunity for people from all over the place.
Well, how are we dealing with this then if we've got three, perhaps four generations now in the workplace? I know, for example, in my wife's family, there's a photograph I'm thinking of where they've got literally four generations of women in that photograph.
Mm-hmm.
But you have that now also in the workplace. And how is it that the young people are tolerating, if you will, or accommodating, if you will, the differences that are being imposed upon them by the powers that be that are in a preceding generation or two or three.
Well, as I say in some of my seminars, I start out talking about for the first time in history, there are four generations working together under one roof, and sometimes it's not pretty. A recent study indicated that one out of three people have been offended by a member of another generation at work. You know, that could include a remark or a joke, an attitude, or more especially, an outfit. So it's not just that the young people are, you know, being maligned or feeling less than. All the generations, Ed, are feeling this struggle and the upset of the apple cart. So you've got hurt feelings and misunderstandings in the office. And then outside the office, when people are networking or trying to build relationships with clients, it's a similar thing. An example would be if Ryan, our new professional, isn't able to eat properly at the table. You know, he's not comfortable. He doesn't know the rules of the game. And he's sitting there with Mr. CEO. He will have a very hard time convincing Mr. CEO that aside from his atrocious table manners, he's a really smart attorney.
Well, you've written a book, which I love, or perhaps it's a pamphlet better described, entitled Business Etiquette 101. And one of the first things you say there, it caught my eye. You said, absolutely never, ever interact with anyone without saying please and thank you. It's so basic. Not doing so makes you look like a total jerk. But that reminds me of the brand new book. I mean, you know, State Bar of California has this civility movement, which I thought was silly. But I know from reading the American Bar Association Journal and so forth that there are about five or six or seven other states seriously considering creating civility guidelines. And it's like, well, wait a minute, didn't your mother teach you that?
Mm-hmm.
But obviously it's a real issue because a Stanford professor by the name of Robert Sutton just wrote a book. I just heard about it. I love the title. It's The No Asshole Rule, Building a Civilized Workplace and Surviving One That Isn't.
Yeah.
I mean, how is it? Are we talking about eating habits, dress habits, or what? What are we talking about here?
Oh, yes. We're talking about all of those social graces that I listed before and, you know, core skills. It's about getting along with people. As you just pointed out, simply saying please and thank you is very elementary to you and me, but a lot of younger people have not grown up in that atmosphere where that was expected.
All right, Gretchen, now come on, let's get serious now. We're not talking about Emily Post, are we?
Well, you know, Emily Post certainly has her place. You know, knowing the rules of social and business engagement, it levels the playing field. And once people know what's expected of them, that's when they relax and can become themselves. So it's like music, where you have to study music, you have to study the rules of music, and once you know that, then you can, if you're a jazz musician, for example, you can improvise. But you have to know the basics in order to get to that point.
I guess I don't understand, because each generation has what I perceive to be their own standards, whatever is considered appropriate at that period of history that they grew up in and that they worked in, and now you've got the four generations together, each with perhaps a different standard. How is it that each group can learn what the appropriate standard is for the other group? I mean, that's one of the things that, for example, the managing partner roundtables that I facilitate monthly, they're having a great deal of trouble with the new lawyers because they don't understand the standards of the new lawyers.
Right.
But by the same token, the new lawyers don't understand the standards of the management of the law firms, the older generation. So I guess two questions. One, how do we learn what the appropriate standard is for each generation? And two, how can each generation, or rather, perhaps better said, what can the two generations, the three generations, the four generations do in order to play better in the same sandbox?
Well, I'm glad you asked. I would say first and foremost, awareness is the first step, and just understanding why people are the way they are and what their expectations are. Whether you agree or you don't agree, that's really neither here nor there. It's just being aware of it. And the next step is to be very explicit about what you want from people in your office. I mean, management needs to say, this is who we are, and this is how we are going to put ourselves out to the community, to the business population, what have you. And I've just written a training manual called Cultural Detective Generational Harmony, and it's part of the Cultural Detective series, which is a tool that helps people understand others. And originally it was started for geographical cultures, if you will, so you could learn more about India, more about China. They're really excellent training tools.
Oh, I thought you were going to say you could learn more about New York and Los Angeles.
You know, there might be a New York one in there, but I've recently co-authored Generational Harmony, which outlines the four generations and how the communication has broken down, and then it'll give you tips on how you can build the bridges that are necessary to cover those generational and communication gaps that exist. It's really a great, very inexpensive way to explore the whole idea of building generational awareness in the workplace.
One of the things I find really fascinating is that one would believe that the management has the power. These are the older folks who, I guess, for lack of a better phrase of characterization, are the old white males. Mm-hmm. That are running the firm, they're earning the greater sums of money and so forth, and everybody would agree that they have the power. And yet, the young folks, the new lawyers, are not acceding to this power, and they have their own approaches. So they'll come in not necessarily with a suit on occasion and the like. They may not work the 2,000, 2,200 billable hours a year because they want to have what they call, and I put this in quotes because I don't really believe it, but it's balance of life.
Mm-hmm.
And yet, these old white males don't believe that they do have the power because they cannot run their law firm engines without the new talent. And so there must be an accommodation between and amongst the various generations in order for this thing called law practice to survive.
I think it's very doable. I think, again, not to beat the same drum, but awareness is such a crucial piece. And then dealing with the new professionals in particular, the ones that you say, you know, may not want to adhere to the old rules or what have you. You know, they're very smart people. They're very tech savvy. There are a lot of very positive things about this new generation, and I don't mean to gloss over that at all. But one thing that they really like, Ed, they like checklists. They like to know what's expected of them. And I say to management often, you don't want your associates wearing flip-flops, for example. Have you said that? And invariably it comes back, well, no, we haven't said that specifically. They should know better.
That's right. They should know that.
But that's the phrase that you have to take out of your lexicon. They should know better. The fact is they don't. So going and being extremely explicit and saying in your policy handbook or what have you, this is unacceptable in the workspace, you know, Monday through Friday. Put down spandex, put down yoga pants, put down flip-flops. I mean, being very explicit and having senior management follow suit. I mean, sometimes you've got senior associates, junior partners, what have you, that they're not setting such a great example either. So it's really important to send that message from the top, being extremely explicit and having folks adhere to it.
That's amazing. Let me pick up two items from your Business Etiquette 101 that I thought was quite interesting.
I like that book.
I love it. I love it. And you mentioned technology, where everybody now, even the old white males, if you will, are tech savvy to a great extent. Clearly not as much as the new lawyers, but nevertheless, one of the caveats you have in your manual is absolutely never ever play with your electronic toys during a meeting. Checking email and voicemail while someone else wants your attention is rude. It is amazing to me how that BlackBerry or PDA is strapped to the waist belt, and it's like an adhesion to the body, and you can't get away from it. And you know, it's like, what did we do before we ever had that?
Right.
We kind of communicated with one another. And I have seen many meetings where the lawyer will sit there in a program, or even, you know, worse, in a negotiation session, and be texting a response on an email in a BlackBerry. How is it that we get our folks to sever that technology during a meeting?
I think it's very similar to what we just spoke about in terms of expectations of wardrobe. You need to, that management needs to be explicit. Example, in a meeting, in an internal meeting, we will not have our laptops open. We won't have BlackBerries. You know, we won't have cell phones. And it's extremely important that upper management adhere to that as well.
So I know of no upper management that has that kind of rule. It's amazing. And part of it is the billable hour. I mean, well, two things. One is the billable hour, because presumably you're billing for that time. And, of course, that ignores the rule of professional conduct that says you cannot bill two different clients for the same minute of time.
Right.
So if you're in a session and you're billing client A, you can't bill client B for that email you're responding to. Of course, that's a whole different topic.
Even if you weren't working for another client and you were just in, let's just say you were in a session, a staff meeting or what have you, are you even going to remember that minute? Are you even going to be able to...
Well, that's the other issue, because unless you record your time as you go, all the studies I've seen indicate that you lose revenue by the tune of about 10% to 15%, because it's just never recorded.
Right. So why not go back to your office, open up your email, deal with the situation at hand, and then maybe that's a 5, 10, 15 minute piece of increment of time.
Right. Well, there's another rule you have here that I want to bring ourselves to a conclusion on, because it's appropriate to where we are in our own time frame, and that is, you say, absolutely never and ever, and I love this, it's absolutely never ever for all of these rules.
Right.
Absolutely never ever arrive late to a meeting. Doing so sends the message that you don't respect the other's time.
It's so true, Ed. You know, when you've got people waiting for you, it's it is sort of a slap in the face. It's sort of like, you know, my time is so much more important than yours. I have arrived. Let's get started. And I don't care if that comes from the top or the lowest on the rank. It's everyone's time is valuable, and offices should do a better job of staying on time and being cognizant of everybody else's time.
Well, Gretchen, we've come to the end of our time in this interview. I want to thank you very much for joining us today.
Thanks so much, Ed.
You have been listening to a LawBiz podcast. For more podcasts, please visit www.lawbiz.com/podcasts.html. Feel free to tell your friends and colleagues about LawBiz podcasts. You may duplicate this program in part or in whole, provided that you retain appropriate attribution and copyright notices.